I heard a story of a missionary who was bringing the gospel to India. And this was in the early centuries after Jesus. And it was a monk, actually, or someone who had committed to celibacy. And in his bringing this message, he was also teaching his cultural awareness of abstinence, not just before marriage, but altogether, just abstinent all the time. And so as he brought this teaching with him, he taught about Jesus, but he also taught that that the proper way was abstinence. And he had quite a few listeners and had won quite a few people to the cause of the gospel. However, he also won the queen over. And so she not only embraced the gospel, but embraced this teaching of abstinence. And the king wasn't very happy. And so the story goes that it actually led to this missionary's martyrdom because the queen had embraced so fully not only the gospel, but the lifestyle that was tied to it. And the king just ultimately could not handle that. So I'm reminded that I want to give the little warning today. We are going to be talking about sex this morning. And so I do try to keep it at a PG-12-13 level, but I also never want to force a parent's hand. And or maybe if you're one of those nonagenarians, you know, and you're feeling like you don't want to listen either, that's fine. But just this is your forewarning. The up to 12-year-olds are in the library. I want to respect that. We're teaching the whole counsel of God, and we're working our way through the Bible. So this is what comes up next. But I also don't want to force a parent's hand to have a conversation that you might not be ready to have yet. Or you're the one who wants to shape it, okay? So even with youth and with me up here, I always give you this preface so that you have the chance to control the filters. Because you can only skate around so much and then it's just real life, right? We're in 1 Corinthians 7. If you're still not sure and you're a parent, you can read the first few verses of that and make your decision. But the reality is, sex is very powerful. And God has given us the constraints of marriage in order to control it in a way, to be able to harness the capacity of this powerful drive, this powerful thing that is within the human being, and really it's so powerful and so potentially destructive that God says monogamous marriage between a man and a woman is the best and most appropriate context for this. This is where it can be safe and fun and just, and I designed it and I made it for that purpose. But outside of that, my goodness, destruction and all sorts of lives can be torn apart by these drives and desires. And so Paul is going to address that. And, you know, we've had a few weeks off from Corinthians now, and we're coming back. And the next few sections here are going to be about marriage and relationships, a little bit about sex. But these are where we live. The thing is, this is an extremely relevant book, letter, and teaching for us today. The people of Corinth were, they had a very sexually saturated culture. This is a drawing of what the old area of Corinth would have been like. Sort of, there's a lower city down here, and then up here was called Acro-Corinth, the city on the hill, the hill version of the city. And there was temples throughout, and one of the temples, especially up on the hill, was a temple of Aphrodite, which was filled with prostitutes. And they had brothels along there, and that was how people worshipped. You'd come and pay the temple tax, and you would get to worship with a prostitute. So, I mean, if you think our culture is a bit has gone downhill, it's really from a different place. Like, I'm not saying that we're in a great spot necessarily, but I mean, it was a very big norm there. I've in some of my reading, and you've heard me say before that Corinth, the city, had a reputation. They had a saying even from ancient Corinth that said, not every sailor can handle Corinth. Or not every man can handle Corinth, because there's so much prostitution and so much that, like, you could lose your livelihood if you're not careful. The gambling and it was like Las Vegas, New York, and L.A. all in one. Huge metropolis. It was a port city. It bridged a small piece of land, and so there were sailors on either side. There's a lot of money to be made. And so it was a very, very immoral town. People actually had that, if you were called a Corinthian, everyone knew that you had less than stellar morals. Maybe, I think they were the ones who originated the saying, you know, instead of what happens in Corinth stays in Corinth. You know, Las Vegas borrowed that from them. And so this was the atmosphere that Paul had planted this church. And the Christians there had come out of this culture and believed in Jesus Christ and started to follow him. But there was a strong pull, as we've covered in chapter 6, there was a strong pull, and some of the people had interpreted some of Paul's teaching as license, which means kind of anything goes. And if you remember, we talked about in one of the previous sermons, Paul was quoting some of the things they used to say. So one of the Corinthian phrases was, everything is permissible, quote unquote. Everything is permissible. And so Paul says that everything is permissible, but not everything is beneficial. Everything is permissible, you say, but not everything is beneficial, friends. Even if you think you could be doing this and like, I have freedom, I can do what I want. Be careful, because that freedom may lead to bondage, especially in the realm of sexuality. People can become addicted. And all of a sudden, the freedom that you're exercising has led you to slavery. And so he said, this was one of the previous quotes. Everything is permissible, but not everything is beneficial. Now he comes to chapter 7, and we come to the text in 7 verse 1, and he's quoting again. Now, again, I have to just give this a little bit of that setup to remind us of the overall picture, right? Paul is writing to these Corinthians who are in this very, very worldly town, very hedonistic, and he's trying to get them to see life through the gospel, to say, with Jesus Christ in your lives, things have changed. The way we see things have changed. The way we interact with each other has changed. Everything has changed. And so he's trying to help them understand the new lenses that they put on when they see through the way Jesus sees. They see through the glasses of what it means to be, have your sins forgiven, to be born spiritually, and to have God living inside you and refining you and purifying you. It means that we live differently. Friends, this is actually very Church of God doctrine. We believe that a holy life will tell the gospel story. We believe that when we experience the power of Jesus in our lives, that things are transformed. There's grace there where God meets us where we are, but he doesn't leave us there. Now, many of these are cliches, and you've heard them before, but it is true. That the goal is that God is making us more and more into the shape and the character of his son, Jesus Christ. And so that's what Paul is conveying. And he goes through, it's very great that we have this letter, because he goes through all these areas that sometimes you're like, well, how do I honor Jesus with my sex life? What? But it's true. God wants us to honor him in every area, to not leave anything out. If he's Lord of us, he's really Lord of all of us, from head to toe. Mind, spirit, and body. And so, Paul is framing this here. And now, as we go through the next few weeks, you'll see the bigger lesson too. So, in this chapter, the umbrella message is this. You don't have to change your status to follow Christ. Okay? You don't have to change your status, particularly relational, marital status, to follow Christ. So he addresses those who are married. He addresses those who are single. He addresses those who are divorced. He addresses those who are maybe married and want to get divorced. And he goes, this is where we're going through the next through this whole chapter. But the overall lesson is, look, in order to follow Jesus, you don't have to make the changes that in your relationship. Because some people are asking, what do we need to do about this? Like, I want to follow Jesus. Maybe I should leave my spouse so I can do that. We'll deal with that in a couple of weeks. But in this case, there's actually some people in the church who are, they've seen the license that is happening over here. There's too much promiscuity, lax sexual morals on this side in the church. And so they've responded the other way. And there's another school, and over here they say, no sex at all. This is the way we really honor God. If we're really going to be spiritual, just avoid it completely. That's because the body is bad. Everything to do with the body is bad. Eating is bad. Every desire, every appetite we have is bad. So we'll avoid that completely. That's how you're really spiritual. So Paul, he's addressing this. They've written him a letter about this. Well, we don't have that letter, but he changes the corner. He rounds the corner a little bit here in 1 Corinthians, and he says, now concerning the matters about which you wrote. So up until now, basically, Paul has heard about what's been going on. We kind of figure that the Corinthians didn't really want to tell him because they had some pretty shameful things happening, as you can recall. Or read the first six chapters yourself. There was a guy in the church who was sleeping with his own stepmom. Again, very reprehensible. Not desired in any way, and Paul is like, shame on you. There's lots of bad things happening, but they didn't write about those. Because they didn't really want Paul to know. They didn't really want him to address that. But they did have some questions. So they did write him something, and they wanted to know a few things. They had questions. But Paul found out those other things and thought, you know what, those are a little more important, so I'm going to deal with those first. Then he comes here. Now, concerning the matters about what you wrote, we'll get around to what you had said, and here we are. Quote, it is good for a man to not have sexual relations with a woman. Now, some of your versions, maybe even King James or an older version, will say touch. Okay, and this was like the very politically correct way of saying this. Okay, touch. So if yours says that, this is what it means, more bluntly. Now, I will also just side note, this has caused a lot of problems in the church through the years because in the early church, they didn't really like realize that this was a quote. So they kind of took it as a teaching without really reading very carefully as it goes on. And so some would say, look, the Bible says it's good for a man to not have sexual relations with a woman, so we just won't. And so a lot of the early days were very much like, you know, monks and some of the teaching, like I told you, that missionary helped the queen get converted, ended his life. Took it very seriously. But this is actually a quote that Paul is giving back to them. He said, so you've wrote to me this thing. So concerning what you wrote, quote, it is good for a man to not have sexual relations with a woman, end quote. Now he teaches, but because of the temptation to sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. Now some people have taken that out of context too and said that marriage is the standard for a Christian. If you're a Christian, you should be married. That is not what he's saying, actually. And you'll see that as we go through the chapter. But what he is saying is, this is the best way to avoid temptation. If you have these strong urges and desires in you, get married. Now, if you have those strong desires in you, you may not realize that some people don't have those strong desires. And he's saying, urging this, he's saying, look, if this is you, because of temptation to sexual immorality, which we shouldn't be doing, each man should have his own wife, each woman her own husband. And so even here, this is actually part of a key development of Christian doctrine in the New Testament about why do we have monogamous relationship marriages? Why do we only marry one person, right? Because in the Old Testament, actually, there's a lot of different polygamy. Biblical characters that had many wives. So sometimes when people are pushing me a little bit, or like, well, I believe in biblical marriage. I said, well, which one? Right? Solomon had, that's the extreme example, but I think it was 300 concubines and 700 wives. Maybe it was reverse. Anyway, you're probably not talking about that kind of biblical marriage. You're probably referring to this. Each man should have his own wife, each woman her own husband. But remember, don't forget, don't interpret this as every Christian has to have a spouse. Because that means you haven't read beyond verse 5 or 6. We're going to get there in another week or two. But it is encouraged. Monogamous marriage is important, partly because it helps us to deal with the sexual urges. The other thing that's really interesting here is that he's not referring to childbearing. Sometimes there's been Christians who have said, no, no, God had created sex to make babies. Okay, sometimes that happens, but that's not the only reason. Right here, we have Paul talking about sex in and of itself to avoid temptation and for the spouses to enjoy each other. So enjoying sex with your spouse is a perfectly biblical, legitimate thing. Let's go on. Verse 3, or 3 and 4 here. The husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights, and likewise the wife to her husband. For the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Let's not stop there. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. This is actually revolutionary. The fact that Paul is advocating mutuality in marriage is absolutely countercultural. People would have fallen off their stools if they read this. What? Men own women. Everybody knows that. That was how it was. Actually, in the Old Testament, when you looked at the Jewish midrash, like the laws surrounding the Torah, the Old Testament, they actually had different penalties if a man left a woman versus if a woman left a man, because of what they owed each other. The man owed a woman, like food and shelter and care. But the woman owed the man so many things. And so actually, if she left him, she would have to pay him a week's wages every week. And if he left her, he'd have to pay her 3 days' wages every week. Because she owed more to the man than he owed to her. Okay, so equality is not everywhere in the Bible, but in the New Testament, under Jesus and under Paul, the teaching that Paul extrapolates, it is there. And this mutuality is countercultural in that day, and also in our day even. Now, not to the same degree, but this is really important for us to realize that husbands don't own their wives. Now, you might say, well, obviously, I hope. If you're still married, then you've probably learned that. But it's really important for us to understand this. Let's go to verse 3. The husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights. Huh, did you realize, husbands, that your wives have conjugal rights? Did you realize that they have a right for you to fulfill their needs? Have you ever thought of that? We don't often think about that. We tend to say, well, men need it more. That's kind of the tendency to believe. But it's both ways. A husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights, and likewise the wife to her husband. And remember, this is give, okay? The word here is give. It is a gift. It is not to be taken. It is not to be withheld. It is to be given. This is important that we note this, because this can be abused, literally. Like, there's been abuse through the years from Christians who have misunderstood this, from men who have thought they get permission from the Bible to dominate women, even within marriages, that they say, no, no, you owe me this. Friends, this is not, that kind of talk doesn't, that's not what is referenced here. That is not taught in the Bible, okay? Each have rights, and each are to give to each other those rights. So there is a little sense of almost duty here, but it's a duty out of love. It's never to be taken. And it's not to be withheld. Because that can happen too, where it could be, well, you know, whatever the spat is, I'm going to control this. And either one of the spouses could decide to exercise control over how much they want to give to their spouse. But that's not the case either. That is not advocated here. He says, we each have authority over the other. Man, really? I tell you, this was like, even for me to read, to look like, wow, my wife has authority over my body. What does that mean? How do I honor her with that? It's important that we just realize that there's times when marriage is tough. Marriage is tough. Even when if you're not married and you think, hey, when I get married, this is just going to be so great and it's going to be easy. It will be great, but it's not easy. Because you need to have communication. And even when you're married to the person and you know them better than anyone else in the world, communication isn't always easy. Sometimes you're saying something and they hear something else. And you can't connect. Sometimes busyness, you can't connect because you're so busy that sometimes you're afraid to say what you need. Have you ever had that? It's sometimes really hard to actually tell your spouse what you need. And when you think of it, you're like, well, it shouldn't be because it's my spouse, you know? And you could tell her or him this and this and this and this. But could you really tell them that? It's challenging. If we're not communicating, we're not going to be able to do this well. This is God's will, and it's meant to help us. But the challenge is sometimes it's been abused. Some of you have experienced abuse. And it could be really extremely difficult to overcome that in a physical relationship. How do you do that? How do you overcome? What if that gets in the way? How do we get help? Where do we look? What do we do? We have to make sure that we don't read in this that there's any taking. You know, in preparation for this, I was talking with a friend. We thought about, is it possible for somebody to be raped in their marriage? And I said it would be very difficult to prove that in a court. But I would say yes. If you say that rape is non-consensual, it could happen in a marriage. But somebody might say, well, no, look, I have rights. You're like, so does your spouse. And you are to give, not to take. You are to share, not to withhold. You each have authority over the other one's body to honor each other, to love sacrificially like God loved you, and then to deeply enjoy the marriage God has gifted you with. But these are parameters. And communication is hard. So we'll get to that in a minute. Let's keep going. So there is power in the mutuality here. I don't want us to miss that. And I did highlight that a little bit, that we are equal. Like each spouse has that right and authority over each other. Okay? It's not you have authority over her or she has authority over you. Except you both have authority over each other. There's a mutuality here. Love each other, serve each other, give to each other. And then the last section here with verse 5. Do not deprive one another, except perhaps by agreement. Okay, here's one qualification. By agreement. Number 2, for a limited time. And three, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer. And number four, but then come back together again. So that, why do we need to come back together again? Shouldn't we just abstain forever? Said nobody. But, so that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. So, I mean, this is sometimes when people are like, well, the Bible's really impractical. It's like, no, actually, Paul's really practical here. And I think it's very applicable to our day and age. With all of the sexualized content we have in our lives every day, whether it's grocery store magazines, online ads, Instagram solicitations that people want to add you as a friend on Facebook or Instagram, or spam emails or whatever it is. I mean, we have so much sexual immorality around us and like bombarding us every day. No one can say, I am never tempted by anything. Like there's, it's everywhere. And if you are, then God be praised. But it's everywhere. And so Paul, I think this is so important to say, like, friends, if you're going to abstain from your spouse for a while, do it, talk about it. Agree to this. Figure out how long you're going to abstain. Devote yourselves to prayer. And then come together again. So that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. I think that's super practical. Wouldn't it be the best if your wife could fulfill all of your sexual desires? Or your husband? Or if that was, they were the main channel for you to pursue for those? Well, that's what God designed. Good news. Even in Corinth, part of the problem was, in that day and age, women were more for like, bearing children. So they're like, well, my wife gave me a couple of kids, so I don't really expect much more of her. I can go to the temple and worship. And so many men would go and find pleasure elsewhere because the wife had given them the kids, but it wasn't her responsibility to try to satisfy the husband. We can go to the temple prostitutes for that. So Paul is saying, no, hey, countercultural teaching here. If you abstain from each other for a while, devote yourself to the spouse. Spouse, you're each other. You're given to each other for this. If you take a break, do these things and then come together again. Because otherwise, Satan's temptation is going to be big and ample because of your lack of self-control. Again, we circle back around to the reminder that the power of sex is immense. It can decimate lives if it's not held within the biblical confines of marriage. Unwanted pregnancy, abortion, sexual disease, and maybe even if you don't have any of that, heartache. Memories of past partners, even as you engage with your current spouse. Now, God can forgive. He does forgive. He does renew. He does make us pure and clean again. But for those who are in the marriage, this is the prompt to you to like work hard at your marriage. Don't neglect this facet of it. Don't think that sex doesn't matter. It does, and God has given it to us, and it's a gift, and it's a beautiful thing. But we need to work. We need to work at it. It takes communication and love. So, what do we do? How do we handle this? What are some tools? And so, I have this book that I'm willing to lend, or you could buy, or get it on your Kindle, or whatever. It's called His Needs, Her Needs. And Pastor early on gave it to me and kind of said this is what he used for premarital counseling. This is what I then used often for premarital counseling. And it kind of goes through, they've done Willard Harley Jr. He's done studies through the years of his counseling experience, and he found that almost without fail, there's a top five needs for a woman and a top five needs for a man. The order varies slightly because everybody's different, but generally speaking, the number one need for men is sex. The number one need for women is conversation. And part of how he drives that home is to say, like, men, Okay, think about how much you think you want sex. Now, what if you didn't have that? Okay? Now, is your wife getting the conversation she needs? Because that absence that you're not giving to her may feel similar. Not for everybody. But a great little book, because there's five needs for each, talks about more than that. But helpful if you're looking for a resource to say, like, I don't even know where to start. The nice thing about a book like this is that you could read it with your spouse, and it can guide your conversation a little bit. There's even some questions. But it helps because sometimes, to be honest, it's really hard to start these conversations with your spouse. It's really hard. And so a tool like this might help. Another one is I have a marriage assessment tool that's online, and if you ever wanted to do that, you could contact me and I could give you the details. But basically, you and your spouse would go through and fill out a bunch of questions online, and then it creates a report based on your answers and kind of highlights gaps. And sometimes that's helpful too, because each of you answers separately, and then you have like, so you answer honestly and separately, and then when you put it all together, you're like, wow, my expectation was this, and yours is this. And we're like, we've never even talked about that. So it's a very helpful tool, and if you would like to explore that more, you could come and see me too. And then the last thing I would encourage is counseling. If you're not sure, or maybe you've hit a snag or a bump in the road, or you've just found that it's really hard for you to communicate with your spouse, and you seem to hit the same wall every time, I would encourage you to find a counselor. And I have some I could recommend if you're looking for a reference. But sometimes it's really helpful to sit down with another person and have them listen to you both and reflect back what you're not seeing in each other. Because once you've been married for a while, you tend to hear with certain biases and you miss some things. Yeah, no, I said that. I told you I loved you. Don't you remember when we got married? That was like 15 years ago, but yeah, I could pull out the VHS video if you want. I have it on record. I said, I love you. There you go. Well, have you ever considered maybe saying that again? Well, why? I provide a good living. Take care of her. Might need to hear it more than that. I don't know. Anyway, sometimes counseling can help reflect back to us and be like, oh, I didn't realize that you had that need for either spouse. So I would encourage that too as an option. And I know some of you would be hesitant. You'd be like, I don't need counseling. Fair enough, but what is your marriage worth, you know? It's a couple bucks to invest, and if it could help you, maybe your marriage goes to the next level of depth of satisfaction and happiness because you invested a few bucks in exploring that with your spouse. Anyway, I did want to give those as your tools. There's some books you could read or borrow from me. Marital assessment tool if you want to access that, or even counseling, I could give you a reference or help you in that area too a little bit. But I just wanted us to realize that it is God's intention for us to enjoy sex within the context of marriage, and that we need to be mindful of that, and that our spouses have needs, and that even in the Bible, Paul has told us we're to honor and respect, and there's a mutuality. And I would hope that we could grow in that even more, and that you would invest in that relationship. Now, for those of you who are not married or widows or single or whatever, again, the text is leading there in the coming weeks. And so this was the focus of this week. In the coming weeks, we have more that Paul will cover. Now, we do want to, as we think about submitting our entire lives to the Lord, including our sexual lives, We want to think about communion. You think about the Lordship of Christ, and part of what we do as we celebrate the death and resurrection of God through Jesus, the body and the blood of Christ that was shed to pay for our sins, to cleanse us of our sins, including sexual sins, He can purify us. That's the miracle. That's the amazing thing, is that no matter what sin we've committed, no matter how deep we feel it's gone wrong, Christ meets us there. His death and his resurrection has paid for it. What a gift if we accept it. If there's something you need to confess to the Lord, confess it. If there's something you need to ask forgiveness for, ask for that forgiveness. He gives it. It is there. He has wiped away your sin, removed it as far as the east is from the west. And he doesn't remember that anymore. He has cleansed us.